consistent with classical principles of teaching. Now, I expect that during the course of this session, I will say some things that will make you respond within you by saying, well, explain what you mean by that. And unfortunately, there will be times during this talk when I won't be able to do that. And so I would ask you, I have a table in the back. Just if you can see Osborne Books, I'm on the opposite side of that, and I'm more than happy to talk with you about any details that I leave out. So please don't hesitate to make me pay the price for my oversights in this session. So classical means rooted in Greco-Roman culture, attempting to universalize around the concept of being and consistent with classical principles of teaching. What is a teacher? A teacher is one who mediates an idea from his own soul to the soul of another. A teacher is one who mediates an idea from his own soul to the soul of another. And so then we come to the concept of what it means to teach, which follows naturally. It is the act of mediating an idea from one's own soul to another's soul. So if you get the definition of either teacher or teach, you'll have the definition of the other. To teach means to mediate an idea from one's own soul to another's soul. Now, what are we talking about when we say training or teaching? Training, I'm talking about development or nurturing or any cultivating, words like that. And it really means, the title of the session, Teaching Teachers to Teach Classically, really means, how do we educate our teachers? How do we educate our teachers? And of course, to do that successfully, we need to begin by answering the question, what makes a classical teacher? What makes a classical teacher? And so we move to my first main point in my outline, which is the objective qualities of a classical teacher. Now, I might as well tell you that you're not going to be able to probably to keep up on the notes because I have 9 attributes, I have 11 abilities, and I have 5 competencies that you'll need, and you probably won't be able to write all these. If one strikes you, write it down, otherwise get the tape or something. The attributes. Attribute number 1. I'll try to comment on them just long enough for you to write each one down. First attribute is a devotion to excellence. A classical teacher must be devoted to excellence. Please remember that we are talking about classical education. And there is a reason that the word classical came to be equated with the best in a class. We think of classic rock. Well, you know it. You get my point. A classic something or other is something that is the best in its class. And therefore, a classical teacher must be devoted to excellence. We have enough love of mediocrity in our culture. We don't need it in our schools. Number 2, the second attribute of a classical teacher is that he has a spirit of inquiry. A spirit of inquiry. It is inquiry that drives classical education. You may say the beginning of thought is wonder. A teacher that doesn't have a mind full of wonderment probably won't make a good classical teacher. Third, love of learning. Love of learning. As has been said, why would you want money when you can have books? So the third attribute of a classical teacher is an outrageous love of learning. To use Milton's word, a promiscuous love of learning. Fourth, love of culture. A love for culture. Now that's one of those terms in our day and age that can be taken a lot of different ways, as are all the valuable terms from the old days. But when I say that, as Christians, I specifically mean that the Christian classicist loves to see the expressions of the divine image around him. Now sometimes, well always frankly, those expressions are contorted and ruined in various degrees, but there's something very stimulating when you understand that it is the divine image in man expressing itself, even in rebellion. Even in rebellion. So there's a love of culture. We love great music and so on. Fifth, this may surprise some, but there's a love of clarity and form. Love of clarity and form. The classical teacher loves form. We live, of course, in a casual, informal culture. Our poetry is informal. Our media are informal. The further west you go, the less formal it is, of course. I learned that because I've moved further west as I've aged. And it's remarkable to me when you can go to opera and see people with jeans on. It's somehow incongruent. It lacks integrity. But we love clear speech. Okay? In our love of clarity and form, we love clear speech. We love clear writing. And there is a desire to understand the form of good writing and good speech. If you compare classical literature with modern literature, the main difference is the formality of it. The strict rules that are followed, for example, in a sonnet. Virgil's Georgics, how incredibly formal the meter is, and the tropes and rhetorical devices that are used. And because of that, the contemplation of form produces in the contemplator a degree of form that's appealing, an appropriateness of formality. Now, that doesn't mean that we walk around in tails and tuxes and evening gowns. It means that we focus great attention on propriety, on an appropriate expression. And I might suggest to you that I'm wandering here, but I want to just throw this out, that the primary principles of a classical aesthetic are reverence and propriety, which is why, if I can be forgiven for saying this in public, I despise VeggieTales. I especially don't like my children watching the Bible story versions in VeggieTales. I don't like Daniel being a cowardly asparagus, and so on. It's not appropriate. It lacks reverence. So number 6, there's a respect for cultural traditions. Doug Wilson, Mr. Wilson, has said in the past that if the Chinese wanted to have a classical education, then they should emphasize their own traditions. I think I'm understanding him correctly. A classical teacher in any culture reverences the cultural traditions. We recognize, as Evelyn Waugh said, that it is in the heritage of our race, it is in the heritage of our culture that a great deal of wisdom is found, and there's a capital that's being used up. He said that in Brideshead Revisited, which is a book I recommend to all of you. Number 7, there is a love of truth, goodness, and beauty. A love of truth, goodness, and beauty. When you hear those words, doesn't that move you? Doesn't that just sound right? Truth, goodness, beauty. The classical teacher has a love of truth, goodness, and beauty. 8, he has a cooperative spirit. And 9, he has flexibility. That's because he's a teacher. So those are the 9 attributes of a classical teacher, as I've listed them. He then has 11 abilities. Now I'm going to have to spend a minute or two on the first couple of them. The first ability is the ability to turn a skill into an art, or into what the Greek called a techne, from which we get technology or technique. The classical teacher has the ability to turn a skill into an art. What's the difference between a skill and an art? Well, a skill would be something like writing or speaking or swimming. The art is the procedure that you go through in order to do the skill. We understand perfectly, it seems to me, that when we're doing sports, there are procedures that you need to follow. Michael Jordan was the greatest because he mastered the procedure so incredibly perfectly. He didn't have to think about it anymore. He was rather in the rhetoric stage of basketball, wouldn't you say? Well, the classical teacher can take the rhetoric of a skill and take it through the stages of grammar and logic and explain to the student objectively how to do it. And so the teacher understands a skill well enough that he can reduce it to the sequence that you need to go through. Now, it's understood that Not everybody has the time to do that, and so we do use books to help us. We have programs. For example, I mentioned Matt Whitling's Imitations in Writing. Well, that's part of the techne, or the art of writing. And so we do use resources, but the classical teacher is able to take a skill and reduce it to the objective, measurable steps that you need to go through to get the skill mastered. Second, he can create a chant or a recital. I'm using the word recital for chant because out where I lived, we find that when people hear chant, they're thinking somewhere between Buddhist and Gregorian. And what we really mean is just a bunch of facts that you say over and over again with a rhythm, usually. And so I've begun to use the word recital for that. A classical teacher can create one of those. He can say, these are the seven facts I want you to remember, now say them to me. Third, the classical teacher can find the needed information to put into a chant. And fourth, he can carry on a dialogue. This is incredibly important. Mr. Wilson beautifully expressed in the first session how knowledge is not the same as education, but you can't have an education without knowledge. How do we move the child from knowledge to understanding? Is it by giving him a bunch of facts and then telling him the summary idea? Certainly not. One of the seven laws of teaching is the law of the teaching process, which means that which states that the student's mind is engaged in the process of pursuing the knowledge to be gained. And the law of learning is that he can reproduce it in his own words. When we talk about moving from knowledge to understanding, the student, the child, the pupil needs to be able to communicate back to the instructor the concept in his own words. That's when he understands it. The teacher can only move a student from knowledge to understanding through dialogue. That's why I'm sort of frustrated this morning, both by time constraints and numbers and presence. I mean, I'm up here rather far from you, and I have to just give you knowledge. That's all I can do is communicate facts to you. If you're going to understand this, you're going to have to think about it. I'm hoping there's a readiness. I'm hoping there's a sense of preparation in you, that you already have enough facts that I'm not creating bridges or rivers without bridges across them. In the cases where there isn't a bridge for you to cross, you will not understand what I'm saying. The teacher is able to bridge the gaps between former knowledge and new knowledge. And the way to do that is through dialogue. The student must be able to talk. You must be able to listen to a student. Fifth ability is the ability to discipline students. Probably that's enough said about that. Six, and this is intimately related with four, but it's the ability to communicate with students. Communicate with students in a language they can understand. Now, in the old days, John Milton Gregory said that the teacher should use the student's language. I believe that, unfortunately, that's come to mean in educational circles that the teacher can talk hip-hop, and I don't believe that. It's a purified version of the student's language that we should use. And it should be a version of their language that we're always supplementing. Communicating with the students is critical. Seventh ability, the teacher must be able to generalize. I'm going to have to explain that one too. You need, as a teacher, to be able to lead the student from specific data to an abstract principle. You need to be able to lead the student from specific data to an abstract principle. You need to be able to distinguish the general from the specific and then see the role and limitations of each. You need to be able to distinguish the general from the specific and see the role and limitations of each. Now, knowledge, again, is the specific data. It's the rote memory. You need to be able to move from that to the abstract principle. It's easiest in science because they've already divided things into genus, plural of which is genera, and that's where we get general, and species, from which we get specific. And so in science, you can talk about specific creatures that belong to a more general category, and the higher you get, the more abstract things get. But you also need to be able to do it in literature, in morals, in history, and so on. You need to be able to compare historical events and lead a series of events to a general abstract principle. So a teacher needs to be able to generalize and to lead the student in the process of generalizing. The eighth ability is the ability to connect new information to old. And that means old information in the student's head, not the teacher's. Okay, you need to be able to raise to the student's awareness things that he already knows, and then connect the new material to that old material. Now, related to that is the ninth ability, which is the ability to determine where the student was disconnected. I think that frequently as teachers, we can see the glare come over the student's eyes and think, oh, they're just not good at paying attention. Maybe. Often it's an act of despair on the student's part, because they're climbing this hill, and you're asking them to see the pinnacle of this hill, and they have stumbled into a ditch that is deeper than they can get out of. And there's two things you need to do at that point. First, you need to pull them out of the ditch, and secondly, you need to make a bridge, again, for them to get across the ditch, or at least swing a rope across or something. Like in Star Wars, you know, where Luke and Leia are stuck on the ledge and then throws the rope across. These movies are very valuable. And 10, you're going to love this one. The teacher needs to be able to take a deductive or didactic text and turn it into an inductive or dialectic dialogue. So let's move on. The teacher should be able to take a deductive or a didactic text and turn it into an inductive or dialectic dialogue. The last two words are somewhat redundant. What I mean by that is you always will use some sort of text in a classroom. Now, I'm using the word text loosely because you might use, for example, a composition, you might use a painting, and maybe that's the word I should use. You will always use a composition in a classroom. You will always have some idea to explore. You will always have something that you're looking at. You mustn't expect the text to create its own dialogue. Okay? The mistake of the textbook manufacturers, Christian and non-Christian, is that they try to be the bridge between the ideas in the text and the student. They can't do it because they aren't there. And I would suggest to you that it's better for you to use, for example, the Iliad without any notes, well, maybe little marginal notes about what words mean and that sort of thing, but without the textbook guidelines that you typically find with a text, and just give them the bare material, and you are there to mediate the understanding to them. That's the job of the teacher. Now, in so doing, what you are doing is taking the text and you are turning it into an inductive experience, a dialogue, a dialectic experience. You are the one who should ask the questions. You are the one who should make up the questions as much as possible. Now, of course, you can use Cliff's notes or Cole's notes or whatever they're called around here. Of course, that's fine. You can use the Norton Anthology questions. Use whatever you want, as long as you understand what you're reading. But you are the one who needs to introduce the questions and guide the students in the exploration of the questions. Now, I'll talk later about what kind of questions should be asked, but the important thing here is that you are the one who needs to be creating the dialogue with the student. If you're reading, for example, the Bob Jones history text and you get to the end of the session and you say, for tonight, read this section and answer these questions, you're being delinquent as a teacher, if I may be so bold. You're wasting the student's time and yours, and you're making history very boring. Forgive me. You're making your class very boring. It is impossible for history to be boring. And you're sinning against God when you make history seem boring to a student. Okay, so there's only 10 there, by the way. I had a word there that wasn't capitalized that I thought was. So there's only 10. Aren't you relieved? Now let's talk about competencies or technical knowledge. I've got 5 areas of technical knowledge that I think each teacher needs to master. First area is the 7 laws of learning, or the 7 laws of teaching, outlined by John Milton Gregory. Other books have outlined similar laws, including The Method of the Recitation, or Bruce Wilkerson's book. If anybody knows it, yell the title out. Something like you can teach almost anything to anybody, almost any time, something like that. Here are the seven laws quickly. The law of the teacher. The teacher needs to know the content, skill, or concept to be taught. In other words, if you don't know what you're talking about, it's best to back off on the teaching. Second, the pupil. The law of the pupil. You need to get his attention. The pupil needs to be active in the process. Third, the law of the language. The law of the language is that the language must mediate between the teacher and the pupil. You need to use a common language. And by the way, I'm absolutely certain that some vendor here is selling the seven laws of learning by John Milton Gregory. If you don't have that in your school, please get it and require your teachers to use it, to read it. Fourth is the law of the lesson, which means that in your teaching you need to move from the known to the unknown. It is when you try to present unknown material disconnected from known material that you throw your child in Joseph's well. And then you have the law of the teaching process. The law of the teaching process states that you must excite and direct the student's activities. Your goal as the teacher is to activate the student, not pacify. To activate his energies. And I like the way Mr. Gregory states it when he says that you should tell the student almost nothing that he can find out for himself. It is the mark of an unskilled teacher, says David Hicks in his classic Norms and Nobility, to answer a question before it has been asked. The learning process. Students must reproduce the truth being taught in his own mind and then in words. The student needs to reproduce the concept or the skill or the content. Until the student can reproduce it, he hasn't learned it. And seventh, the law of review and application, which means check to make sure they know it and can use it. So those are the seven laws. The second area of competence or technical knowledge is something I've referred to a few times already, and it's the ability to carry on a dialogue. Now, there is a method developed in the late 1800s, or I should say formulated in the late 1800s, that really goes back, I think, to the dawn of teaching time, called the recitation, the method of the recitation, and I'd like to just very briefly state that to you. When I do teacher training, it really focuses heavily on this, because this is a procedure that applies the seven laws very tidily to every single subject area that you can touch, and it is a five-step process, the method of the recitation. Step one, preparation of the student's mind. Preparation of the student's mind. The first thing you need to do in the teaching process is prepare the student to learn. And I think the best way to do that is, as I've said earlier, to raise to the student's awareness the things that he already knows about the subject you are going to talk about. So if you are going to talk about, for example, the Civil War, you might begin with a discussion with the class in which you say, "How many of you have ever heard of the Civil War?" Of course, they'll all raise their hand and say, "Yes, that was in England in 1688, wasn't it?" And then you can carry on your discussion. And then you ask them what they already know. Tremendously useful process. And as it takes time, by the way. It's probably the thing you'll skip the most because it seems the least productive. It's the most obviously beneficial, the least obviously beneficial when you're doing it, but the most probably beneficial in the long run. It adds an incredible efficiency, and it also helps you to understand what they know and don't know. So you prepare by raising to their awareness, by getting them to state what they already know about the subject. And you can do a number of other things to get them interested. And by the way, they already know something about everything you'll ever teach about by the time they're in kindergarten. If, for example, you're going to talk about the Iliad, and you're going to talk about Achilles and Hector, it's very easy to remind them that they have had fights, after all, with their brothers and sisters and friends. The themes of great literature are universal themes. Good things like fighting and hurting each other and power struggles and brother-sibling rivalry, sin, you know, that sort of thing. So you begin with a preparation. The second stage in the recitation is the present. What did I just say? Did I say preparation? I meant to. The second stage is presentation. It is after you have prepared them to receive the material that you present the material. Now, for example, if we're talking about the Iliad and you have prepared them to receive it, now you read it. If it's a history lesson, this is the point in which you do your lecture, or this is the point in which they read a text. This is the didactic portion. You present the material. Third, comparison. The third stage is comparison. This is where you can make comparisons either internally or externally in the material. This is probably most easily seen in math, where if, for example, I'm going to teach two-column arithmetic instead of one-column arithmetic, my preparation stage would be to put 7 or 8 one-column addition problems on the board. They already know how to do that. Show them it, ask them to do it, and then ask them to explain how it was done and that sort of thing. Get them to state as much as they can about the old knowledge. Then I present to them two-column arithmetic, probably by doing 3 or 4 of them myself. Now, the important thing is whether I do it myself or whether the student does it, the important thing is that they stay in front of their eyes so that they can make comparisons. And so then I will say, how was the two-column arithmetic similar to the one-column arithmetic? And then I will say, how was it different? It is incredibly important to get students thinking in terms of similarities and differences, especially differences, the two kinds of differences, which are the difference in degree and the difference in kind. They don't have to understand those terms, but they need to think about those differences very early in life, because you want them to argue well, and almost every political discussion is a difference in degree rather than difference in kind. Many theological discussions are too. In any case, they need very early in life to be involved in the process of making comparisons and reasoning through the comparisons. Now remember, you're not trying to teach the student the process of the recitation. They don't need to know that they're doing comparisons. They simply need to do the comparisons. And that will lead naturally, properly done, to the fourth step, which is the step of definition. After they have seen a number of comparisons, you want them to state the concept or the skill that you're trying to instruct them in. So if you're trying to get them to understand how to do two-column arithmetic, you don't tell them. You get them to say what they've been doing. You get them, by virtue of comparison, to see how it is unique from the other processes. And you say, what are we doing here to do two-column arithmetic? And it's best if you have 3 or 4 or even 5 students come right out and say it. Ideally, every single student will say it, but frequently we don't have time for that. Now, if they can't say it, the wonderful thing is, as frustrating as it is at that moment, you know that they don't understand it. And so you can back up to comparison again. If they can't make the comparisons, then you can back up to the presentation again. If they get cloudy during presentation, you can back up to the preparation again. And so you always have some way of knowing where to be in the teaching process. So after the comparison, you get to the definition where the student defines the concept, and then you go to step 5, which is application. In math, that's the homework assignments. Do this 30 times. Okay, you're applying it then. Please be careful. You don't necessarily need to apply it to life, and with the little kids, I recommend you not do that. They don't really care about life. They're more interested in the subject matter, frankly. It's a wonderful thing. Life is too far away for them. So you apply. In history, it would be to write an essay about the issue that you were just discussing. By the way, I would urge you to have students, by the time they're in third grade, to write at least one essay a week. That would be an application in history. An application in Bible or in literature would be the same thing. History and literature deal with the same questions. They just look at them from different points of view. In science, you go through the same procedure. An application in science might be that they do an experiment themselves, or they do a paper, an essay again. It depends what level you're teaching. So the five steps are preparation, presentation, comparison, definition, and application. If they can't apply it, they haven't learned it, so you need to go back to definition. But you always have somewhere to turn, and that's a very nice thing when you're stuck. Now, the third domain of technical knowledge or competence that teachers need to understand is what I'm calling, or what Mortimer Adler called, the three columns. The three columns. It's very important as a teacher to know what it is you're teaching. And there are three kinds of teaching that you will do. The first is teaching a skill. Column one would be a skill. Now, how do you teach a skill? You teach a skill by coaching. Skills have to be taught hands-on. You don't teach writing by giving a lecture on it, any more than you teach basketball by giving a lecture on it. It's a skill, and therefore you need to coach the child. Of course you tell them things. Of course there is a small room for lecture, but basically it's a skill, so you coach them, and you give as close to hands-on instruction as you possibly can give them, including specific statement of how you do something, evaluation of how it was done, procedures you go through, and so on. But you coach skills. The second column is content or knowledge. Knowledge. And knowledge, this is where the lazy teacher can find it really easy. All you have to do is lecture to them or read to them. I am in the content business this morning. Now, I heartily prefer dialogue, and that's why if anybody wants to do lunch with me or anything like that, I'm more than willing to do that because I love to discuss an idea. But there's a place for content communication. And when you are doing that, that's when you can lecture or that's when they can read a text. But understand that when you're lecturing or when the student is reading a text, they will only get knowledge out of it. And they will need your guidance in which knowledge they're to get out of it. The third column is concepts or understanding. You're trying to move the student to an understanding of a concept. And as I said earlier, the only way to move them to an understanding of a concept is by discussing it through dialogue. So the three columns are skills that you coach, content that you tell, and concepts that you discuss. Now the fourth area of technical knowledge or competence is the mundane everyday planning, and I will leave that to you because there's too much detail, it's much too specific to discuss in a session like this. And besides, that's the easiest part to learn by trial and error. And then fifth is evaluation. How do you evaluate the students? And I will do the same with that, except to say that you must evaluate knowledge differently than you evaluate understanding. You must evaluate skills differently than you evaluate knowledge and understanding. Content is where you can put, as Mr. Wilson explained, the 97. Rather easily. In a skill, I suppose if you've completely objectified the skill and you can say he has the three areas of qualities of a classical teacher, attributes, abilities, and technical knowledge. I hope it's been some use. We're going to have to really move now. I think I have 10 minutes left to talk about the obstacles and what you really want to hear, which is the strategies. So I'm going to throw things at you very quickly here. I've been trying to be sensitive to your note-taking. I'm going to cast aside my sensitivity at this point. What makes it hard? What are the obstacles to becoming a classical teacher? Well, one is imported educational baggage, specifically progressive in the modern sense theories. For example, the divorce of induction and deduction. The apparent inability of modern educators to combine the deductive text, as I explained earlier, with the inductive process. You need to be able to bring them together. There is no goal to progressive experience. Progressive education is based entirely on experience, and it doesn't have an objective, and then we come along and bring in classical objectives, or Christian objectives, even worse. And they get very frustrated by that because it's tyrannical and so on. They prefer the tyranny of emptiness. Third is the limitation of the teacher's authority. I think it's very common for young teachers when they join classical schools to give in to the emphasis on softness and subjectivity. I believe cruelty is a very important element in a teacher. Why is everybody laughing at that? The teacher should have great authority over the student, because in the student's mind he does, until he steps outside of it. And that creates catastrophe. I'm going to illustrate this very briefly with a political analogy that will get me in trouble, probably. But I believe I know why George Bush lost the election in 1992. And it's schoolyard principle, that if a student is challenging the authority of the teacher, the rest of the students are watching to see who wins. And if the teacher wins, the rest of the class will follow the teacher. And if the student wins, the rest of the class will rebel against the teacher and follow the student. Well, when Bill Clinton was, forgive me, lying to the American people so blatantly in 1992, I, for one, was watching the debate, waiting for Mr. Bush to say, "Mr. Clinton, you're a liar." And had he done so, he would have won in a landslide. But because he was not willing to do that, he was not willing to exercise his presidential authority, the country despaired of leadership and elected Mr. Clinton. Forgive me, please, if you're in favor of Mr. Clinton. I will run out the side door quickly if you raise your hand to indicate that I may be in trouble. Fourth, an overemphasis on detail and data to the exclusion of universality of principles. This is almost humorous. The modern educator says we don't want to waste our time on rote learning, but that's what they waste most of their time on. There's a great confusion. They spend an awful lot of time on details and data because they don't have universal principles in progressive theory. So progressive theories are some of the imported educational baggage that get in our way. Secondly, our educational experiences. Some are those that didn't work. Sometimes they tried something and it didn't work. Trial and error doesn't necessarily lead to wisdom because you have too much variety. But you also have, and even worse, those experiences that did work. I get really nervous about hiring people who have been teaching in the state schools or other Christian schools or any other teaching environment who are excited about things that happened in their environment, not because they're necessarily wrong, but because frequently bad methods can produce good results in a bad context. And then you bring them into the classical Christian environment, and they're wanting to go back to the things that worked in that other environment. And sometimes the worst things are the experiences that were successful. So those get in the way. Another obstacle is imported cultural baggage. Attitudes toward children and childhood. I do not believe that childhood is for having fun. I believe that they have all kinds of fun. It's we adults who need to have fun. Second is the attitude toward work. The Bible says it is good for a man to bear the yoke in his youth. I believe that children should be required to work very hard. And a third one that I'm particularly sensitive about is an attitude toward book learning, toward academics. I ain't book learned. As though book learning is something separate from life. That bothers me. I suppose it's because my parents were so faithful in teaching me the scripture, because I never could understand how book learning would be relevant to anything other than life. Of course, there are times when you read just for the pleasure, but gee whiz, pleasure is part of life too, isn't it? But more so than that, I have always found books to be a phenomenal, incredibly relevant source of wisdom. And I don't understand. How are people reading books? How are they reading them if they can't see the relationship between a book and life? Or what books are they reading? Either they need to change the way they read or what they read if they have that problem. But that is a cultural baggage. We tend to see life here and books here, and that concerns me. Books are a source of practical wisdom. Next is the postmodern disintegrated mind. The postmodern mind has an obsession with false dichotomies. And Mr. Wilson talked about that in the first session, so I'll leave it at that. We also have a great problem with ignorance. Our culture is obsessed, isn't this funny, with censorship. Politically correct and all that. we have so much censorship in our culture. The media regards itself as self-censored, and so on. We are intimidated as Christians. Third obstacle is psychological, by which I'm not referring to psychological theories, but two facts of teaching life. One is discouragement. Any teacher in this room that hasn't been discouraged is either really, really gifted or hasn't been trying hard enough. It is the danger of any form of idealism that we smash right into the wall we were trying to jump over. What do you do when your nose is broken and you're lying on the ground with the birds spinning around your head? Well, hopefully you have a headmaster who's going to heal your wounds and throw you over the wall. But we need to deal with the discouragement, because when you are an idealist, which is what a classical educator is, you get discouraged. In fact, every decision we make is a compromise between our ideals and the resources of the present reality. And second is ambivalence. We are always stuck trying to decide why we should be doing this when we really aren't that great. Leads to an ongoing lack of confidence. So the third obstacle is psychological. The fourth is ignorance. There are areas about which we are all too ignorant. For example, the classical theory of education. Well, this is 2,500 years old, and I would say most of what we understand about it is based on Dorothy Sayers' essay from the 50s. There's an awful lot of theory that's been presented over the last 2,500 years, and we need to expand our understanding of that theory. Second is an ignorance of the relation between nature and grace in varying degrees. I don't claim to understand this fully, but I was staggered when I read these words in Thomas Aquinas when he said that grace does not destroy nature but perfects it. Growing up as one who regarded nature as evil and grace as good, that shocked me, and I've spent the last 6 years thinking about the relation between nature and grace. We need to work that out. Third is classical ideas. We need to know what classical ideas are, like wisdom. What is wisdom? What is virtue? What is nobility? Classical history is important. We need to know it. We need to know the Bible. Imagine that. We need to know teaching methods, like the universal stages of learning, things I've already gone over, and we need to know the material that we're going to teach. Okay, fifth obstacle is expectations. Please understand that teaching classically is extremely hard work. A word to the board. Your expectations on the teacher need to be... You need to understand that you don't understand them. Only a teacher understands what it's like to be a teacher. It seems from the outside to be a relatively easy job. It is not. You walk in at 8 in the morning or 7 in the morning or whatever time, and you are at war with the nature of your students for the rest of that day. It is exhausting. And you have to be psychologist and babysitter and everything else while you teach. It is intellectually exhausting to teach properly. If teaching is easy, it isn't being done properly. There is too much work on the classical Christian teachers in our movement. They are being required to do too much. There is too much assumed knowledge. They need time to study and to learn. And it is not easy to acquire knowledge. Expectations on the student are also important, but we don't have time for that. Six, the abilities. The obstacle of abilities, by which I mean lack of them. I'm afraid, now a word for teachers, you need to learn how to write. And you need to learn how to discuss things. And even if you hate it, you need how to learn the music of mathematics. Because classical education involves four mathematical arts. You need to learn to hear math sing. Even if you don't like it, you need to hear it sing. Seventh is time and commitment, the obstacle of time and the degree of commitment. And now we come to the real point of what I wanted to get at, which is how do we get there? Well, you select teachers, you train them, and you dismiss them if they're no good. I think I have one more minute, so I'll try to say something about this. You need to structure the whole school, around the pedagogy that you believe in. Everything. If you possibly can, the building, the posters on the wall, everything must communicate to the teachers, students, parents, and everybody else that they're walking into a classical Christian school. It is a formal environment. It isn't casual. You need policies that outline the parameters of all the relationships and roles within the school, and you need policies that explain discipline and communication. Please keep information freely moving in your school. Oh boy. I'm out of time. I will take my notes on teacher selection, teacher development, and teacher dismissal and put them onto a handout. And if you want one, come to my table in the back and I'll print some up for you. I apologize for not having this more prepared. As I discussed, I am involved with CIRSE and do teacher training in-house for schools. And if you're interested in that, please see me. I also have a book I want to urge you to purchase called Norms and Nobility, which is up there with Mr. Wilson's as one of the great works on explaining classical Christian education. Thank you for your time. One verse for you as we go from Ecclesiastes chapter 8, in which the preacher says, "A wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment, because for every matter there is a time and judgment, though the misery of man increases greatly." Thank you. God bless you.